This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey, everybody. This is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producers are Patrick Antonetti and Sean Cherry. Two guests this week. First up, a frequent guest, that's Sports Business Daily media writer John Orand. He's been on the podcast many times, and we sort of have a catch-up media session on some of the bigger topics going on, including just how crowded a schedule things are going to be if these big leagues can come back, and what that means for all the different networks in terms of juggling and scheduling and advertising. It's going to be a really interesting time in the sports media. John and I go into college football and what his reporting tells him about the prospect of college football and whether it will be played this year and where it will be played this year in regards to the media and the networks. Also get into the Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson exhibition match, which was incredibly successful to Turner Sports, and what that means heading forward with those two, as well as some NASCAR talk and NASCAR success and whether it can ultimately provide more viewers for NASCAR heading forward. Katie Strang follows up John Orand. She is my colleague at The Athletic. She's a senior NHL writer as well as one of our investigative reporters. We talk about Gary Bettman and the NHL's return to play plan, what Katie thinks that means, and then beyond that, the sort of media implications there about potentially covering the NHL within that bubble, what it might mean for access. And then we end with Katie's recent reporting on sexual abuse allegations in youth hockey. She's done some amazing reporting on that, and I recommend you checking that out on The Athletic. So John Orand first, followed by Katie Strang, coming up on the Sports Media Podcast. All right, as I said at the top, John Orand has been a guest on this podcast many times, and he joins me once again as we hit the end of May 2020. John, first and foremost, how are you and your family doing?
Exactly the same, Richard, as we've been for the past 2.5 months. That whole Groundhog Day is for real down here in D.C.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody listening to this everywhere sort of probably getting a little cabin fever. So if you have little kids as I do, it's very much the NCAA tournament, survive in advance, basically on a daily basis. All right, well, hopefully we'll give you at least something, if you're into sports media, something hopefully interesting and entertaining over the next hour or so. All right, John, the schedule, you know, again, everything we're talking about here is, sort of relies on testing and local and municipalities and states sort of allowing sports to be played and leagues getting together with their players association. So I'm going to ask you some questions sort of under the presumption that we can get to a place in sports where we hopefully can be, understanding that there's so many contingencies at play that who knows ultimately what will happen. If the major sports, John, can get to where they would like to be over the next couple of months, the schedule is going to be as crowded as it ever has been in sports. So let's start with a macro question for you. What do you think this is going to mean regarding all the networks that have all these sports media properties?
So for sports viewers, it's going to be awesome. Because you're potentially going to have a situation where you have the NHL playoffs competing with the NBA playoffs, competing with college football, competing with pro football, competing with golf majors that have been pushed back, big horse races that have been pushed back, pretty much everything. And I think one of from a business standpoint, though, it's not a disaster. The networks, of course, won all this. But, you know, what's the ad market going to look like? I mean, the ad market already is, pretty close to zero right now. And the ad market going in there with a glut of high-profile programming and programming competing against each other is going to necessarily, almost certainly, bring down the ratings. So I can see an ad market that, where the prices just drop considerably this fall. On top of that, I think one of the stories that I can't wait to see is what happens on a Masters Saturday when CBS has the SEC going up with the Masters. What will get relegated to CBS Sports Network? What would get relegated to another Viacom channel? And you can take that decision and put it on just about every single network, because networks are going to have really hard decisions to make. Like, do we preempt the NFL, which almost certainly won't happen, or do we preempt another, major longtime partner? So those are going to be really interesting discussions from a behind-the-scenes business standpoint.
All right, so let me ask a couple questions on this, John. One, do you think the networks will work with each other to try to do their best, even though it's an impossibility to avoid any kind of conflict? Do you think Fox, ESPN, CBS, NBC, in some kind of informal way, get together to say, hey, the NBA Finals are on this date. Any way you guys can, sort of work with your partners in the NHL to work around this date? You know what I'm saying? Like, will the better question is maybe the leagues will get together to sort of do their best when it comes to scheduling. But you wonder if the networks will make that ask to try to get a little bit of exclusive windows.
I find that really hard to believe. Number one, you're going to ask the networks then to go back to other, their league partners and say, hey, we're prioritizing the NBA, even though it's going to be on ABC. They don't do it anymore, but there was a time where people did try to counter-program the Super Bowl, and tried to counter-program, other big events that are going to be on other networks. It is sort of a new era, and you would think people would try to get together, but there are going to be so many sports, and everybody wants to bring in their bit of ad sales, and they're going to just be too many sports. Like, what are you going to have them programming against the NBA Finals? Because they're still going to have some sort of programming in there. If I were running a network, I wouldn't really be listening to anybody unless they were going to be, floating some money my way.
Do you think there is will there be some kind of thought from either the sports leagues or the networks to avoid Sunday NFL, if the NFL ultimately is playing? Because the one thing that happens, John, with this glut of sports is, strikes me that it might be hard to avoid a Sunday in the fall. This, again, presumes the NFL is back.
Yeah, the NFL is the one league that has the most leverage over everybody, and the NFL is not scared to use it. And the NFL has a rights deal that's coming up with all the networks that they're in the process of negotiating. And I would expect that a network like CBS that wants to stay in business with the NFL, or a network like ESPN, ABC that is desperate to get a bigger piece of the NFL schedule, isn't going to do anything to overly upset the NFL. Would the NFL go to ESPN and say, hey, we don't want a program on ABC to go against sort of Sunday afternoon NFL? To be honest, I find that hard to believe. I've never heard that happen in the past, and ABC is a program network that is trying to get viewers as well. But if anybody was going to do that, it would be the NFL. If anybody's going to do that successfully, it would be the NFL.
John, you mentioned earlier the ad markets, and I think that's something that we're going to be learning and reading a lot about. Again, if this ultimately happens, the companies that usually buy into televised sports are going to be in, they're quarterly projections are going to be horrific. There's going to be, if there hasn't already been layoffs and furloughs, you wonder if the ad buys, whether it's you know, automobiles or movies or you know, household products, how drastically down do you think that will be when it comes to these networks attempting to recoup some money?
That's the big question, because the ad market right now is, you know, everybody has sort of fled the ad market. And right now, like, nobody's buying cars, and nobody's certainly nobody's going out to, you know, quick service restaurants or fast food restaurants that much. And those are some of the biggest advertisers that are out there. And it's an impossible question to answer about what that market is going to look like in October, or what that market is going to look like in November. But I know, just in talking to various TV executives, they're not viewing this as sort of like a, you know, 6 month sort of setback. This is like a 3 year plan to try to get back to whole, or a two to 3 year plan to get back to whole. So, you know, if you look at the ad market in just from this year alone, from 2020 alone, that, like, nobody's doing that. They're trying to broaden it out to a bigger sort of 2-3 year plan to try to, you know, recoup some of those losses.
You know, John, one of the things that and you've written about this a little bit, or you're certainly colleagues at Sports Business Journal have, the one place where I really wonder what's going to happen is college football. You know, I've certainly said this on Twitter, so I'm happy to repeat it here. I find it truly, I don't even know what the word would be, just disgusting, the idea that college football players would come back and not be paid. If they're going to play college football in a pandemic or post-pandemic world, and post-pandemic is probably not even accurate, they're workers. There's no way around it. I mean, you know, I'm making a bit of a editorial statement here, but like it literally is the definition of work if they are basically going to if they're going to play, if they're going to put their bodies on the line in front of either no crowds or crowds that are social distance. You're basically saying we're going to protect the public more than we're going to protect the players there. If they're pros and they make that decision as adults, that's their choice to me. That's fine. I could respect that because they're making a financial choice. In these cases, these kids won't be doing that. That gets me to John, the larger issue of there are clearly parts of the country that have experienced COVID-19 far harder than other parts of the country. How can this be reconciled with college football when games are played against, you know what I mean? Games are played against teams that compete in different parts of this country. Do you think we will see college football this year? Because it seems everything I've seen with the networks and the colleges, they seem to really want it.
Yeah, well, I think we'll definitely see college football this year, but it's going to be a completely different year than people expect. Because, as you said, each conference, and even in some respects, colleges within those conferences are going to make different decisions about whether to play or not. You had, you know, Jack Swarbrick, the AD at Notre Dame, say that his team was not going to play in empty stadiums. I think he walked that back a little bit, suggesting that, you know, they might do that. But, you know, what about, look, I have two kids in college. They don't know, we don't know whether or not they're going to be on campus this fall. If the kids aren't on campus, I find it very hard to believe that, you know, to your first point, like, you know, they're not going to get paid this fall regardless. College administrators view the football players as student athletes, which is, you know, not necessarily an emphasis on student, but student is in there. If the campuses aren't open to students, I would expect most colleges are not going to allow, you know, those students to go out and play in a sport in football. But there are different areas of the country right now, like the SEC, you know, they could make a decision that is completely different than the Pac-12, which could be completely different than the ACC or Big Ten. And then within the Big Ten, you know, Rutgers, like, which is in ground zero, and Maryland, that's in a hot spot, could be making completely different decisions than, say, Nebraska or, you know, Penn State. And so it's a right now, there are just so many questions that are out there. I would say the likelihood is there are going to be some conferences and some teams that are certainly going to play an abbreviated schedule, and there are going to be certain leagues and conferences, certainly outside the Power Five, but even some of the schools within the Power Five that are going to take a step back and not play. That would be my prediction on that.
My sense is you're probably going to turn out to be correct. It's incredibly distasteful. If you're interested in this, I had a long podcast last week with Booger McFarland, who played at LSU, so obviously played at the highest level of college football, and absolutely spelled it out that, you know, if I'm a pro, if I'm McFarland Inc. or Brady Inc., you know, I'm a grown man. I make that decision based on my finances and based on who I am at 24, 25. If I'm a college kid, you know, who's still under the guidance of parents and stuff, they're asking me to come back to campus. They're asking me to play in either empty stadiums, or they're asking me to play in stadiums where the fans are set up to social distance. But you want me to bleed and sweat and be on the field, regardless of whatever the sort of the rates are of contracting this virus for under 25. He found that incredibly problematic, as do I. But anyway, enough for the editorial there.
I would suggest, though, that Booger McFarland of the LSU Booger McFarland would make a different decision than the current day Booger McFarland.
Well, of course, but that, which is what he's saying. He's basically saying that, like, as a 19-year-old or an 18-year-old, you want to play. He said that. Like, you know, your whole life, you dream of playing for LSU and going into Death Valley. You dream of playing for Clemson, or you dream of playing for Alabama, but you're 18. And you're making that decision, I think, on a lot of testosterone and emotion, where you would hope that the adults in the room, in this case the college presidents or quite frankly even the network executives, are not putting you in potential harm's way. So I agree with you. I think 18, 19-year-old athletes of that caliber who dreamed their whole life of playing college football, I'm sure it's 99.9% of them, John, who want to play. I don't think that's again, I'm just speaking for me. To me, that's not the point. The point is that this highlights more than anything the hypocrisy of the NCAA calling these guys student athletes. If they're coming back to play college football, they're workers. You are trying to make money off them as a university, or you are trying to make money off them as a television network.
Here's the unique thing about it, as far as I'm concerned, is that, you know, these aren't necessarily coaches. These aren't going to be coaches or ADs that are making the decision whether to play or not. This is a decision that's going to be made outside of that athletic bubble. It's going to be made by college presidents or university presidents, and they have a different view. I mean, they're the ones, high-minded ones, that do use the student-athlete label, and they're the ones that view them.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but because I'll give you feedback here. But ultimately, what's going to guide those decisions, John, is some kind of is finances and economics going to decide that decision, or will health and safety and some kind of morality to guide those decisions?
Well, if you look at it beyond football, we're asking the same question with my kid's school. Like, are they going to open up the campuses because they feel a financial imperative to, or are they doing it based on keeping the kids safe? I think that is the question of the pandemic that goes beyond college football and beyond pro sports as well, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% there.
Imagine sleeping in the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's iconic sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code Odyssey. So head to BOLL&Branch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
You had some excellent reporting this week, John, on the Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson golf.
See, Richard, this is why I like to come on this podcast. You always like build up my stories like that. I appreciate
that.
Yeah,
I think any media person, reporter who came on, I'd probably say the same thing, even if I didn't think it was great reporting. I'm just trying to butter them up. No, but in this case, it was really interesting because I have not seen this anywhere except you. You reported that Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson are under contract to participate in one more golf exhibition with Turner Sports. So the initial deal would have been three exhibitions, and it has to take place. The third exhibition sort of has to take place within the next 12 to 18 months. You report that Turner and the golfers each reserve the right to pull out of the deal. So here's where I want to get to with you. The Brady Manning thing was obviously a mega success on viewership, mega success on critical praise. It was great and fun to watch. What do you think? And again, understanding that some of the viewership numbers is amped up for sure because it was not competing against anything. But what do you think the success of this means, John, for this kind of enterprise, this Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, and then add whoever you want to make it interesting? What does it mean heading forward?
God, if there's one truism about television, it's that every network sees what works and is successful and tries to copycat it. And it happens in entertainment television. It happens with sitcoms. How many sort of Friends series did every other network try to launch after the success of Friends back in the 90s? All the way through. So you can bet that every network is looking at these numbers and looking at the sort of the critical success. Did anybody have anything bad to say about the match on Memorial Day weekend? It was it was just really well produced. It was a lot of fun. It went on maybe a little bit long. I think it was more than 4 hours to watch, but it was it was pretty. It was good television to watch. So on one hand. You can bet. I'm certain that Turner and other sports networks are going to try to do something similar to this. The one thing, though, and you alluded to this, the numbers were amped up, but there's a sense that Turner, especially, they caught lightning in a bottle. I mean, they had. Charles Barkley giving grief to Tom Brady, and he turns around and makes like a shot from like 100 yards out, for a birdie, and it was just like you can't script that. I mean, that was a pretty amazing piece of television. You had a monsoon basically come, and they're playing in the rain. You had everybody with the COVID sort of sheltered at home. With no other sports, there was nothing on. I guess NASA. There was a NASCAR race for part of it, but there was really no competition for it. And so, that number, I think it was like 5.6 or 5.7 million viewers, which the biggest viewership in the history of cable television for golf. That viewership is. It would be really hard to replicate that, but that's not going to stop other networks from doing it.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is very much related to I'm talking about the viewership number, very much related to the pandemic, its stay-at-home orders. It's not to say that they can't do an entertaining event, whether you use other golfers, whatever, Rory McIlroy and Dustin Johnson, but I don't think we're going to see this replicated even with Woods and Mickelson doing it next year. But for Turner, listen, great publicity.
Also, the charitable component of it is that's something else you can't replicate. I mean, 20 million to a COVID fund. When else can you do that? So everything conspired to make this as successful as it was.
Agreed. Yeah, it's not a bad thing. It's not going to happen again, but that's okay. I think they will do this for sure one more time, and I think people will be interested, and they may get a little bit of a pop from this year's event, and people sort of wanting to check it out again. They're probably going to have to figure out a way to. I think find two other very famous people, whether that's famous athletes. This isn't going to happen, but like if you had Tiger Woods and LeBron James versus Steph Curry and Phil Mickelson, I think people would tune in. I mean, I think that'd be fascinating, but I don't know if that's going to happen again. So we'll see how that goes. But
yeah, I don't know if you can find like the two other people that had the chemistry of, you know, like Brady and Manning and Mickelson, and Tiger didn't talk a ton, but, like, you know, those three just had this, like, chemistry going that was, like, just really cool. And that's another part that's going to be really difficult to replicate.
Yeah, I was thinking the other day, like, is there a singer, or is there an actor, or is there a politician, is there a sports figure? I don't know. I don't know. There's no one who you sort of just can name off the top of your head that, that sort of automatically makes it a can't miss.
How about if you do something along the lines of a mini Ryder Cup, and you bring in, you know, a couple of European golfers to go against Mickelson and Woods, or you make it a generational thing, and you bring in Jordan Spieth and, like, you know, a couple of the younger players to come in to play Tiger and Phil, and you sort of make it a little bit more, you know, golf centric than you know, bringing in the ex quarterbacks.
I think the event becomes better as a competition, but I think you lose viewership because you don't bring casual fans in, would be my
yep
answer.
Absolutely.
But I agree with you that becomes then a more kind of a more interesting golf exhibition, and they may opt to do that. The one thing usually when these things, John, happen is that you're right, everybody tries to copycat it, and you do a lot of them, and then they eventually fade. You know, everybody tried to do the Battle of the Network Stars kind of concept for a while, and then it faded, and, you know, Superstars concept, then it faded. I think you'll see that happen with this.
Well, remember, NBC had NBC did a similar event just a week earlier, and it didn't get nearly the amount of buzz that Turner's did. So you know, it isn't something that is guaranteed to have success, but you can still people see those numbers.
Probably going to get some emails from Chris McCloskey and Dan Masonson about that, but I'm fine with that.
Didn't have the buzz, McCloskey. Come on, it didn't.
The sports that have returned, John, NASCAR, and full marks to Fox for their NASCAR production, which I think has been excellent. UFC, Bundesliga. Will any of these sports, John, you think, when all the other sports come back, will the pop, the viewership pop that they've gotten, you think any of this will be sustainable? You think any of this results in some kind of small, long-term growth for those sports?
That's the hope. I mean, NASCAR is, you see these stats about the number of people watching their first NASCAR race over the last, 2 weeks. They've been really hurt by weather, so I'm not sure what's going to happen with them. I think UFC is one that, you know, a lot of people just wanted some competition, and you take a look at some of those pay-per-view numbers. It was more than just casual fan, or it was more than just the hardcore UFC fans that were tuning into that. And, you know, the idea that a lot of these sports are having is that there's this window of time where you can put your sport out there and just market it to people, and that's why, as a baseball fan, that's why baseball's killing me right now, because, like, they can go and they can bring in fans that have fallen away from the sport. They can go to younger fans, because there's a window now between now and the end of July, when the NBA says it's going to come back and the NHL says it's going to come back. There's a window where it would be the only thing that's on, and I would have to imagine that, you know, the first ones out are getting people to sample it, and if you sample it, you're going to be more likely to come back. So yeah, I think anybody that's coming out early is going to see a nice little pop out of this.
You know what? I don't know how much NASCAR you've watched, John, but I've really been impressed by how they've navigated this broadcast with announcers in Charlotte, the race wherever the race is, either Darlington or Charlotte, obviously in the last one, graphics people in Los Angeles, and without the fans in the stands, it feels like a real race. The audio to me is really, really good. I think Mike Joy and Jeff Gordon do a really good job for not only hardcore fans, but for casual fans. And I will say this, and this is just sort of my observation. And I obviously grew up in New York, so I'm sure a lot of NASCAR fans would think of me as a Yankee. But I have been to six NASCAR races. When I was at Sports Illustrated, I did a 7-week project where I went to or 8-week project. We're into 6 NASCAR races, part of a really in-depth NASCAR viewership poll where we did it on site. And it gave me great appreciation for the sport, and I fact-checked Ed Hinton, who's one of the legends writing in the sport for a long time. So I got great respect for the sport. And but, John, here's the sort of interesting thing with me in terms of growth. It is not the easiest sport to sort of follow if you don't watch it week to week, because it's not like, how do I sort of say this? Like, there's not an exact winner, like, of everything. Like, yes, you get, you know, the person who wins the race, but there's stage wins. And there's certain points that you get in the point system. Like, let's say if you get out of the pits earlier enough. You know what I mean? It's interesting in that it's one of those sports where I feel like you have to watch for, like, 7 to 10 weeks to sort of get it. And I wonder how many new fans will really make that investment. I feel like that's a little bit of a problem that they have to overcome. And maybe there is no overcoming it.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things NASCAR has spent years talking about is the need to sort of highlight a lot of the driver personalities to get people to identify more with the drivers in terms of that. But the thing about NASCAR and no fans is that the audio around NASCAR is so built on just the noise of the cars and the sounds of the engines going around the track. I mean, so much so that, you know, Fox has that one little bit where the announcers stay quiet. I forget what they call it, but the announcers stay quiet and they just listen to the sounds of the track, you know, as they're going around. And so you don't necessarily miss. I think the only time that I missed having a crowd at NASCAR is at the very end when there's a winner and the guy gets out of his car to you know, silence just about. It's not as dependent on fans as, say, you know, baseball or basketball or any sort of arena sport.
We'll finish up on a couple quick things here. Your initial or top line thoughts about whether you think the Foxes and the ESPNs and the NBCs of the world will pipe in some kind of external crowd noise when more sports start coming back.
Yeah, 100%. That's going to happen. Everybody I talked to said that when they watch a game with no fans and silence, it's utterly disorienting. And so they have been looking to Brad Zager of Fox said in the story that I did for Monday's issue. He called it scoring the game, you know, and so they're going to have, you know, and the example he used is when Cody Bellinger comes to the plate in the second inning, you know, the crowd sound is going to be different than when he comes to the plate in the ninth inning down one with two runners on, you know, and they want to be able to, you know, have the crowd sort of or the track sort of scored to that point to where you can do it. I think I haven't actually watched it myself, but I've heard nothing but positive things coming from the Bundesliga doing that. You know, they have singing in an empty stadium, they have cheers at the appropriate time, booing at the appropriate time, and they do a nice job of it. I've been watching some Korean baseball on ESPN, and they're not necessarily scoring the game, but they do have just like a track of the sounds of a stadium in the background that just sounds natural. It doesn't sound natural when there's a home run and it's the exact same sounds as when it's ball two, but it just provides a little bit more activity in terms of audio. And everybody I talked to said that, you know, you can expect a lot more of that when these leagues start to come back.
My other thought, John, again, I think a pretty obvious one is I think you're going to see a ton of remotes heading forward. I think you're going to see so many broadcasters doing games from ESPN's headquarters in Bristol or Los Angeles or Charlotte or, you know, now in Fox's case in Los Angeles. And then you wonder, what does that mean long term? But I think in the near term, maybe outside of, let's say, the NFL or the biggest of the big games, I think you're going to see a ton of remotes. And certainly for the locals, like the RSN types, what do you think?
Oh, long term, definitely. Right now, you just mentioned what Fox was doing with NASCAR. I mean, now is the time to sell stock in the Four Seasons, Richard, because there are going to be less networks sending production people to games. And one of the benefits, if there's a benefit, one of the benefits of having no sports right now is that all of these networks are sort of sitting back and they have time to plan. because typically a network goes straight from, you know, baseball into college football into basketball, and they're just rushing from one to the other. But now they're stepping back and they're saying, where can we cut costs? Because they all need to cut costs now, and not lose video quality. And they think that you know that they're looking at what Fox did from L.A. to Charlotte to Daytona, and you and I couldn't tell a difference on the broadcast. I don't think anybody could in terms of that. So why do they need to travel? The idea of like these massive production trucks for a midweek baseball or basketball game, those are going to be a thing of the past pretty soon, I think.
Well, that would then also tell me, John, that what's going to happen is you're going to see salaries come down. Maybe not the Joe Buck or Al Michaels level, but I think you're going to see a lot of mid-level broadcasters at national places, and maybe broadcasters at who do stuff for RSNs. I would think the salary structure, their networks are going to try to, and outlets can try to bring that down. They're probably going to try to bring that down regardless, given obviously the fact that, you know, we've just suffered an economic catastrophe here. But don't you think that leads to that as well? Less people on site, less salaries.
The pandemic is accelerating trends across businesses. And that was a trend that was happening before the pandemic hit, and it definitely is going to be something to keep your eye on. And again, not for the top line, not for Joe Buck or Al Michaels, but or Mike Tirico, but definitely for the mid to lower level broadcasters, that's definitely something to keep an eye on.
Here's the last one, John. I know we've talked about this a lot, and it's we're only going to spend a little bit of time on this here because it's going to be something that I think we'll talk about down the road more. We're heading towards the presidential election in November. I sort of feel like myself repeating this, but certainly the most polarizing election of our lifetime. As we're taping this today, there are a ton of people on Twitter obviously talking about what happened in Minneapolis this week. Do you think regarding the city erupting over George Floyd's death, and obviously I would say many parts of the country erupting about that. Do you think, John, we are going to see the networks, and particularly ESPN, which has really been sort of out in front of this, try to tamp down as much as they can on their people being public about anything that revolves around politics or social justice, or social issues, or can that not be done, you think, in this heightened climate? Interestingly enough, and again, this is just my own editorializing, Fox Sports does not really give a shit about what their people say publicly. I think that's beyond clear. And in a sense, it's probably better to be talent there because your company doesn't, sort of seem to put restrictions on you when it comes to your social media feed. Which, quite frankly, is something I appreciate. But in ESPN's case, John, they have been beyond clear when it comes to this stuff. But, you know, we're seeing tensions rise in the United States almost on a daily basis. Do you think they're going to be as steadfast to tamper this down as we get closer to November?
I think you said it. ESPN has been extremely clear under Jimmy Pitaro that it wants no part of this, no part of having its on-air talent talking about anything other than sports or the intersection of politics and sports. CBS the same way, NBC the same way. Fox, they are a little bit different there. I think if they left to their druthers, they would have the same way. And I expect because it's so polarizing now, it would be the same way. But I'll even take you back to 2015 when there were race riots in Baltimore. That was at a time when it was leading into a polarizing election then, and that's when all the networks decided that all the sports networks decided that they didn't want to have their sports talent giving political sharing their political viewpoints. I don't see anything that's changed in the ensuing sort of 4 years from that.
Joe, we're not going to get into this now. Can you believe in 2020 that Rush Limbaugh was once hired by ESPN in 2003?
He was fired for the Donovan McNabb comment, I believe, right?
Correct, yes.
Yeah.
Just amazing. Amazing, though, to think about in a 2020 prism okay, what's going on in this country, and just Limbaugh himself, that once upon a time, Rush Limbaugh was on ESPN's most prominent NFL pregame show. It's amazing. Amazing to think about today, 17 years later.
That should be a 30 for 30. That I think, was that like 3 or 4 weeks? I forget. I even forget about that.
Good question. Not many. But you know, there were weeks. It wasn't days. So it's amazing. And by even go back then in 2003, by the way, the viewership numbers for a ESPN pregame show were probably way, way higher than they are.
Those were the halcyon days without Twitter trolls, Richard.
Yeah, we live in interesting times. John O'Rand is sports media reporter for the Sports Business Journal and Sports Business Daily. He comes on the show. John, I'd even talk about Sportico. You consider them a big competitor?
Oh yeah, they're being bankrolled by.
Yeah. I think you are their primary competitor. Is that fair to say?
I would say so. They're bankrolled by Penske,
yeah.
and they got a bunch of really good journalists, including a lot of your old colleagues as well. Yeah,
I know.
Let the games begin, Richard.
When you start going on other podcasts, I might be bringing Scott Soschnick on to start pissing you off, basically.
I'm America's podcast guest, I thought.
I know, but now the stakes are higher now, John. Show some loyalty is what I'm saying. That's all I'm saying. All right, John, as always, I appreciate you coming on. Thank you.
Anytime, RD.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua, and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter, and he said, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film, and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, as I said at the top, Katie Strang is a senior NHL writer for The Athletic, but she has many more jobs at The Athletic. She's someone at our place who does some incredible investigative work. I know she's in the middle of continuing investigations on the handling of abuse allegations in the hockey world. We'll get to that a little bit at the end of this conversation. She's absolutely one of my favorite colleagues and one of the best people that I work with. And for these purposes, at least on this podcast, we're going to sort of focus on the NHL because of the major news that hit this week about their return to play plans. And Katie Strang joins me on the Sports Media Podcast. First off, Katie, how are you and your family doing?
Thank you for asking. We are doing well. I am blushing at your intro, and I have to say that you're one of my favorite colleagues as well. I don't know if you ever remember this, but do you remember me fangirling, like when I met you for the first time at a New York bar and I spilled red wine all over you?
Yeah, I appreciate how you're reading off the script that I sent you right now, Katie. This is very nice. It's very sweet. But I'm serious. I am serious about this. I think you are basically the best of what we do at The Athletic. So it's totally awesome to be able to share a masthead with you.
Well, the feeling is mutual. My family is great. My kids are both driving me crazy and keeping me sane, but everyone happy and healthy, so no complaints.
Nice. All right, this podcast is over, Katie. We've that's it. No more questions, and we've mutually praised each other and take care. All right, so here, the reason to bring you on today, I mean, there's always good reason to bring you on, but for this one is Gary Bettman and the league announced significant return to play plans. It's clear the league's been working on this for a while. I want to start with sort of your top line thoughts on the plan, but then I'm going to ask you some media specifics about that. So when you saw the plan to return, how they're going to construct the playoffs, the fact that the regular season is over, they also talked about how they're planning to do the draft. As someone who's covered the sport for a long time, what were your initial takeaways on that?
So initial takeaways, obviously, like any other person, sports fan, hockey nut, you know, it's always encouraging to see the sort of wheel slowly turning towards some optimism and some more, I'm couching this a little bit, but some more concrete plans toward a return to play scenario. I was relieved to see that they just basically finally said, hey, we're going to nullify the end of the regular season. They were pushing to complete that for quite a while, and I thought that was, basically a foregone conclusion from the very early days. So I'm glad that they scrapped that. I'm glad they're just focusing on this playoff format, which I think could potentially provide a ton of excitement for people and for hockey fans specifically. I will say, I think everyone got that sort of initial surge of excitement. And I hate to be a Debbie Downer here, but I do think it's important to temper that excitement with the fact that this is a return to play scenario that is still, in my mind, very hypothetical. There are so many hurdles that are left to clear from a logistical and health and regulatory perspective that I think we should all be shouting from the rooftops in anticipation of hockey. But I also think we need to realize that we're not even close yet, and there are a lot of things that need to be worked out before that happens.
I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, you live in Michigan, so you're close to the Canadian border. I obviously live in Toronto, and one of the big things that really has to be addressed is that if the NHL wants to play in Canada in one of these hub cities, and I'm sure that would be ideal for them given the Canadian, where the Canadian dollar stands, there's a real issue because the Canadian government at this point is requiring anyone who comes over the border to isolate themselves for 14 days, to quarantine basically for 14 days. That's full stop. No one at this point has been allowed to bypass that. And I don't know how the NHL plays in Canada, Katie, if that edict remains.
Yeah, I think you're smart to, you know, recognize that as a major impediment, not necessarily to playing at all, but playing on the timeline that I think they'd like to play on. And you know, there are just so many variables, you know, when it comes to this, you know, cross-border scenario, and, you know, not to mention that you have a ton of European players who need to get back from their respective countries, and where, you know, different players in different countries have been abiding by different policies. I mean, Sweden's been pretty wide open. Other countries have been a bit more conservative. So you have this wide spectrum of policies and procedures, and then you have to create some level of standardization in terms of health and safety protocols. And you're right that, you know, any player coming to Canada, no matter what, whether or not they're deemed an essential worker or what have you, they should, you know, they will not be, and they should not be exempt from having to do that.
As someone who covers the sport, what kind of access would you want or expect?
Well, those are two very different things. What I would want is, you know, probably as much as you could conceivably have without imperiling reporters or players, whatever is sort of advisable from health officials in terms of, you know, working conditions that are, you know, fair and pretty open without putting anyone into danger. Now, I don't know what that looks like. And I suspect no one else does really either. You know, I know that the last time I was actually out in public, save for, you know, my bi-monthly grocery trip, is I was at the rink, and that was when they were just starting to engage in policy of, like, bringing players out rather than having people go into the locker room and cordoning off an area that provided a player and reporters ample space to interact. You know, that, to me, if you look at sort of the impetus and this cascade of actions taken, not just in sports, but nationwide, one of the really early indicators to me that this was something serious is that, you know, the leagues did start to restrict access and change access and adhere to these protocols to try to protect athletes. And so I imagine we will see a very enthusiastic effort to do the same when hockey returns. I don't expect to get any of the same access that we did prior to this, is what I'm trying to say.
Would you, Katie, would you, if let's say they offered certain media members access inside whatever the pub city or bubble will be, you know, so let's just sort of play it out. It's Columbus and Vegas. I'm making that up. Would you be interested in covering the NHL, let's say, as one of four or five designated reporters who goes inside the bubble, but within being inside that bubble, you have to leave your family for a certain amount of time and you're there until the duration of whatever that tournament, however that tournament ends?
Probably not. I mean, I would, you know, that's a tough, this is a question that I think players are grappling with. Do you feel comfortable being away from your family for months at a time and incurring risk to do so? And so the short answer is probably not. I have two young children. I have an incredibly supportive husband who has been largely holding down the fort for us throughout this quarantine. We're about 10 or 11 weeks in. And so the stress that he has already incurred, having to be essentially the primary caretaker with not a ton of help for me, has been tremendous. And, you know, compounding that with me being gone completely and also potentially putting us at risk, no, I don't think I would feel super comfortable with that yet. Now, if that scenario presents itself, I would be happy to talk about that with, you know, my family and obviously my bosses at work. And if that was something that they felt was necessary, I would consider. I imagine you're going to get more young reporters without families maybe volunteering for those spots. I mean, covering a playoff run in the NHL is one of the funnest, but also most like exhausting experiences ever. I love covering the NHL playoffs. So I say all that. I hope that sort of underscores like how serious my concerns are. But I love covering the NHL playoffs more than any other sporting event on earth. And I would be hesitant.
How, let's do one more on this, and then I want to get to some of the investigative stuff you're working on. One of the things that I think journalists in all sports are a little worried about is the lack of access that's going to exist during any kind of pandemic, you know, any kind of event that goes on during COVID-19, during this pandemic. Naturally, access has to be restricted because of health and safety protocols. And I think there's certainly worry among a lot of people in sports that these kind of restrictions will ultimately continue post-pandemic, if there is a post-pandemic. But the restrictions continuing post-pandemic, and once access goes away now, it's just going to be continued to chip away and chip away. How do you view that? Because you're obviously someone who has, you know, especially when it comes to NHL, Katie, you've been in a lot of dressing rooms and you've been on site at a lot of major events, and you understand the importance of access when it comes to doing the work that you've done.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's a really legitimate concern. And I'd be lying if I said that I don't agree that I think it will be difficult to claw the entirety of that access back once it is, you know, taken away. And there's no one that's going to argue about the utility and the need to restrict that access now and probably in the immediate future in any resumption of play scenario. But down the road, if that access continues to erode, I think that is a really serious concern that journalists have. And, you know, to give some context about why that's important, and it's not always obvious, I think, to someone outside of our industry, is, you know, what you are covering is, yes, the sport, right? But what the most compelling things that people read and really want to read are stories about people. And so the human element is so incredibly and critically important of this job. And the way that you form those relationships with players as people, and not just athletes, is to have that sort of informal interaction within a locker room setting where you're talking about things relating to hockey and oftentimes talking about things that are unrelated to hockey. That's how you build trust and gain a rapport and how you gain insight into, you know, the person behind the athlete, and you get a more qualitative look at, you know, the person that you're dealing with. So I certainly see the need to fight for that access and why it's important. But I also recognize that we are in an unprecedented time and that safety is paramount.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss, 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Katie, as we're taping this interview on Thursday, May 28th, you know, you're in the middle of breaking news reporting. I'll read the lead that you just posted to The Athletic. U.S. Hockey President Jim Smith is under investigation by the U.S. Center for Safe Sport concerning his handling of allegations of sexual misconduct and abuse by a youth coach, The Athletic has learned. USA Hockey has also hired an independent investigator to probe Smith's business dealings with an Illinois youth hockey affiliate. In February, you reported on some pretty significantly disturbing sexually abuse allegations involving a Chicago area coach and junior hockey players. And this is something you've been reporting on for a while. Man, Katie, this is not easy reporting that you do. It's really important reporting, and a lot of people appreciate it. But you want to just give us a sense of where this story stands for you. And man, just as a reporter, it just, I don't know how you do it every day where it just doesn't sort of corrupt the soul, some of the things that you report on.
Yeah, well, I, you know, only half jokingly, like, tell people that bourbon really helps. but simply, like, it can be very depressing, but it can also be very affirming in ways too. And what I mean by that is a lot of times when people share experiences about sexual abuse, it can be really cathartic and therapeutic and healing for them to tell their story and reclaim their story. And you know, one of the most horrible, insidious things about sexual abuse is the isolation and the shame that comes from it. And when people realize that they're not necessarily the only person that experiences a certain thing, there can be tremendous solidarity. And I, you know, from reporting this story, I've certainly seen many instances of this. And additionally, like, you'd be shocked at how many people, like, that I cold call, who have no reason to help me, other than they feel it's the right thing to do, choose to do so, even when it could really blow back on them. And so that's always a really affirming thing to me, that whenever I get depressed about, you know, the state of the world and sports, and I remember that there are always people that are willing to help and to do the right thing. But to give you a Reader's Digest version of what's going on right now. So, in February, I reported about several former hockey players of a very prominent Chicago area youth hockey coach who said that he sexually abused them over the span of many years. And he bounced around from basically every prominent youth hockey program in the greater Chicagoland area. He also coached briefly at University of Minnesota. And, you know, the initial story was about, you know, the abuse and those very courageous victims that came forward to talk about their what they said happened. And then the subsequent stories have really focused on the institutions surrounding that coach and the culture of those institutions and to try to basically examine how this person who was alleged to have done these things for so long was able to continue to get jobs and jobs and jobs. So the latest iteration of that is that the current president of USA Hockey, Jim Smith, was a prominent, very influential member of the state affiliate that oversaw Chicago Hockey. And several people have told me, and I've reported this, that they, you know, one person said that they have, they told this person about concerns about sexual misconduct. Several other people have told me that they feel very confident he knew about this and did not take action. So the latest iteration of this is that the U.S. Center for Safe Sport, which is a central clearinghouse that investigates claims of sexual abuse within the U.S. Olympic Committee's purview, is now investigating Jim Smith, the USA Hockey president, as well as other members within AHI to see if they handled complaints about sexual abuse in a proper way. And in addition to that, USA Hockey has hired a third-party investigator to probe his business dealings with that AHI affiliate, that state governing body, to see if there were any inappropriate business relationships or conflicts of interest. He owns a printing company in the Chicago area, and that printing company has been contracted for services both with AHI, the state affiliate, and with USA Hockey.
You can read Katie's work on The Athletic on this. Head to her archives. One of the things about The Athletic app, as well as desktop, is you can follow writers specifically. So every time she has a new story on this, it'll pop up. It's really important work, and I'm glad she's continuing. Katie, when the NHL eventually gets back, and knock on wood, that will be sooner than later, I will have you back, and we'll be very, very specific on the NHL. But you know, continued good health to you and yours, and thanks for all the reporting you do. And in all seriousness, thanks for being a great colleague at the Athletic.
I was going to say the feeling is mutual. Thank you for having me on and letting me discuss it.
This is like the biggest Mutual Admiration Society interview I've done in weeks. So it's very nice. I appreciate it. All right, Katie Strang, follow her on Twitter for sure, and obviously follow all her remarkable work at The Athletic. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
All right, back to wrap up. My thanks to John Orand and Katie Strang for their time, their insights, and for an excellent conversation. If you like this kind of stuff, head to the Sports Media with Richard Deitch archives, and I think you will find something that will interest you. Prior to this episode, we had a long conversation with the ESPN analyst Booger McFarland about his time on Monday Night Football, as well as what he thinks of the prospect of college football players coming back this fall. Also, Fox NASCAR producer Barry Landis, who discussed how to put on a NASCAR race if you're Fox during the middle of the pandemic. Very labor-intensive stuff, even though you are not on site. Before that episode, Tom Verducci on the new normal of covering baseball. Tom Verducci, I would say the best baseball writer of his generation. Before that, Bob Costas, a long conversation with the iconic sports television journalist. And then head back basically through all the archives, and I think you will, if you're into sports media, you'll probably find something that you enjoy. The way this podcast stays going is obviously, in addition to you guys listening, it's ratings and reviews. So if you like this stuff, please leave us a 5-star review, shoot a comment. The people who run this podcast certainly check that out. Let me thank again my producers Patrick Antonetti and Sean Cherry for all their hard work. Thanks to everybody at Cadence 13, including Chris Corcoran, Spencer Brown, and John McDermott. Thank you to the listeners. I hope everybody out there and their families are safe and healthy. And we'll see you again on the Sports Media with Richard Deitch podcast.